chocolate notches back.
Yes, I am. Messed up your timing a little bit.
Oh, man, no. Joe Biden's going to cure cancer.
No, he's not. No.
Hey, turn that music up. I need it more.
Al Gore made the internet.
Bernie Sanders got economic bill of rights for us.
Oh, finally we're going to be free?
Ugly men in dresses at your local library?
No, thank you.
Man.
They just want to get back to their communities.
Welcome to Cross Politic. It is good to be here with my man, Chocolate Knox. I felt like my left leg was missing for like two shows.
I was looking too.
Were you? Good.
I've been mad for like a week. I want to talk to Jared Longshore and Tom Askell.
And Jerry.
Can we get them on the show?
We'll get them on the third segment.
They're coming on the show. Yes. And we also got the Masculinist. Aaron Rand coming on the show. He's good. You guys got to join that.
Happy Father's Day. Speaking of masculinity, happy Father's Day. And hopefully you got your man, your dad, your father, something really good, like maybe a holster from Tenacore. Tenacore is an American design, development, and manufacturing company focused on creating concealment products built for everyday use. Mm-hmm. Tenacore designs uncompromising products that work. Their designs, like the Velo Appendix carry holster, are purpose-built to keep your gun hidden and optimize performance. You guys use these, right?
Yeah, I got them. I pack it at church.
That's right. So you can it supports reliable guns trusted by professionals, including Glock, Sig Arms, Smith & Wesson. And if you use the code CROSSPOLITIC, you get a 10% off. And one of them.
One of these
bad boys.
So I put this on my backpack, and when I was in Alabama, everybody was stopping me saying, what is that? That's nice.
It's a patch you can get from Tenacore at tenacore.com.
Yes. It's the only way you can get it.
I see. There's no other way to get it.
No other way.
You got to order something from Tenacore and put in the Cross Politic code and they will send you one.
And send you one of those patches.
And you get 10%
off. And they're a Christian company. You guys, you support them. You're supporting us.
Yeah.
And when you join our club, you're making sure that Chuck Knox never has to leave me again.
Yeah, right. And
you guys got to understand, when David leaves after about 2 days, I'm like starting to get nervous. And after he doesn't answer my phone.
I got nervous immediately. he said he was leaving Friday. And I said, okay, thinking that was after the show.
7 o'clock in the morning. I
want to talk to Jared.
Anyway, but I almost brought all the Baptists together with this little thing right here. They gave me at the SBC a messenger badge.
Did you vote?
I second a few motions.
You can't take communion, but you can vote.
What is going on with the SBC?
You're a little concerned.
You're letting a baby baptizer vote in the convention?
Your kids.
That's right.
Women can preach. But you ain't baptizing the baby.
And a black Presbyterian can vote.
Yeah.
All right. The most courageous city in America is in Texas.
Okay, give it to him.
That's right. Wascom, Texas.
Who? Texas?
Wascom. Wascom.
I think it's right on the border, isn't it?
It's on the border, and also borders Louisiana also. So it's
Texas,
down,
Arkansas, Louisiana.
Southeast.
Kind of in there.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Arkansas would be up. Anyways.
Mississippi,
and
Alabama.
And so they have passed a resolution for a sanctuary city for the unborn.
Right. So we've
talked about this play here on the show.
So an abortion clinic is now sort of preemptively banned from coming. So there's no current abortion services available in Wascom?
Wascom,
Texas.
Uh-huh.
But they wanted to prevent an abortion clinic from being able to open in this city. And so they've declared themselves a sanctuary city for the unborn.
Well, and they declared organizations like Planned Parenthood criminal organizations.
Right.
Right.
Criminal. This is wonderful.
Absolutely.
This is absolutely. I think when we were getting ready for the show, I'm just going to say it for you. Wascom, Texas is the most courageous city in the United States right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And we need to be praying for them.
And there's only 2,000 people there. A little courage begets more courage.
The five men from that city council who voted for this measure were faithful and courageous men.
Yeah.
And this is what we need to see a bunch more of.
And now when Planned Parenthood targets your city to open up a store, you gotta stand up.
And the thing that I heard, and I don't remember where I saw this or read this, but was the thought was they're around the border of Louisiana, and so if Louisiana just passed or is about to pass a pretty significant abortion ban.
Yeah, they did.
And they said that they had heard rumblings that there was some talk of Planned Parenthood maybe trying to open something right on the border in Texas. so the people who had it from Louisiana could have access to abortions in Texas. So they were, I don't think it was, it's, so it's not just saying, you know, no abortions here because no abortions here, which would be good enough. I mean, I think cities should do that anyways, but they also saw the potential of a play being made that an abortion clinic really could be open there because Louisiana has banned abortions or is about to ban abortions, and Texas doesn't yet have the balls to do that.
Yeah.
By the way,
my city will.
Katrina Jackson, who is serves District 13, District 16 out there in Louisiana.
I've reached out to her. Have you? I want to get her on the
show. I want her on the show.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So does the sheriff now have to support and implement that?
That city ordinance?
Yeah.
We should talk to that sheriff.
Question. That's a good question.
Well, actually, that would be city police. Probably.
It'd be chief of police.
Unless the city's so small that they just fall under the jurisdiction of the county. Is it counties in Texas?
It'd depend on how, counties and cities, right?
So it'd depend on
the local structure there. But there can be organizations in the county that aren't allowed in the city.
So that does happen. So like Chick-fil-A gets kind of pushed out of places because of the county doesn't want them there or something like that. So
you could go to the city or something. Yeah, you could go something like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, talk to your city council. Talk to them about what they're doing to protect your children, the unborn.
Yeah.
But we also need to talk to them about ugly men in dresses trying to read storybooks to our children.
This is how the Washington Post described what's happening in this particular controversy. The organization Drag Queen Story Hour started in late 2015 in San Francisco, just as the country's reinvigorated right wing was coming into form. But it has found many fans with chapters in areas outside traditional liberal cities, outposts now
That's
in Milwaukee, New Orleans, Charlotte, Mobile, Alabama, and San Marcos, Texas. So this all began in San Francisco. This isn't some organic, you know, just a local person who decides, I want to help the kids, right? This is, to a lot of people, organized as an attempt to advance a particular agenda or viewpoint or understanding and beginning itself in San Francisco.
Yeah, to me, where it began is really irrelevant. I think the question is what's happening in these events now? And I think you have a lot of people who are upset about it. They're upset about it because, and your guest, I think, articulated that perfectly, that they're disgusted by certain people in society, by the LGBT community, by drag queens, who, by the way, are not always a part of the LGBT community. And they feel that their children will be contaminated if they come into contact with these people. I think that's not a mainstream view. I don't even think many conservatives, agree with that anymore. I think that's the point. Well, if you read these stories, that are coming out about these events, and you listen to the individuals who are actually reading the stories who speak for themselves, they're saying, we were looking for a way to give back to the community. We are entertainers. We dance, we sing. We make merriment in various establishments, but we were looking for a way to give back, and they wanted to pour into the children of their community. These events are voluntary. Nobody's children are being forced to go and sit in front of a drag queen and listen to a storybook. They're going there because they want to give back to their community, and I think in the United States of America, anyone should be able to do that.
Looking for a way to give back to the community.
Oh my goodness.
Earlier in the interview,
making merry in various establishments.
Yeah. From
strip clubs
to libraries. Now, what is it?
Old friend Jonathan Merritt. First of
all, he loves us.
Oh man, our old Jonathan.
Wait, if you guys missed it, we interviewed him last summer,
August,
on his book Learning to Speak God from Scratch.
August 12th, 2018. Go find the show.
Yeah.
We talked to him and it was a little awkward.
It did. It did get a little awkward. But what's the play being run here?
He's not a Christian.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry. First of all.
Can we put him outside? I was asking, can we be done with him?
He is on record blaspheming the word of God.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been called to repentance. He's been told he grew up in the SBC.
His dad was former president.
Yeah. But he is manifestly identifying himself as an apostate, not a Christian. He's maybe a member of the covenant, and he has not been formally put out, but he's a wolf.
But my question is, why libraries? Why bathrooms? Why are all these awkward places
interestingly
a point of attack?
Last week we talked with Michael Dougherty yeah. about the whole conversation between Sohrab Ahmari and yeah. David French.
Which yeah. was really good, by okay?
It's a That's an in-house family conversation.
It's a that conservative needs to happen. Yep. food fight.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And, but it started with, the tweet I read last time was Ahmari saying, basically, if you have room in your conservative politics for drag queen story hour,
yeah.
You're part of the problem. I'm putting words in his mouth. But he said there's no third, and he used David French, no third Dave Frenchian way, a sort of middle ground, mild way of sort of kind of being okay with this and not being okay with this.
Right.
He says, we have to win this.
Right.
And I think this is, so the reason is that this is an issue is because it's grooming.
Of course.
Okay. They are grooming children.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. And the whole point of it. And
you normalize it early.
And we didn't play this part of the clip, but the drag queen that was the clip that Laura Ingraham had on her show that she played was this drag queen talking and saying, maybe when kids see someone like me, they will think, I have some interesting feelings about this
too. I'm a little odd.
Maybe I will be like that. The whole idea of grooming, and this, the irony in all this is, how much people are talking about abuse right now. The abuse stuff. Abuse, sexual abuse, SBC, all this stuff. And you read any of the literature and they talk to you about how sexual abusers groom their victims.
Right.
They are people they know. They are people that they trust.
Right.
And these abusers build trusting relations with them and then they slowly transgress norms.
Right.
That's the whole play. Read the literature. And they transgress norms to make certain things that ought to be naturally disgusting, foul, offensive,
repulsive,
abominations. Yep. They begin to seem a little less weird.
Yeah.
A little less strange, a little less repulsive and disgusting.
Yeah.
Mm. Yep. That's right. They normalize it.
And what they're doing is they're getting people just used to the idea of a man in a dress.
And
in a bra.
That's right.
A man. And why do they want to do that? Because they have an agenda. They want to normalize sexual perversion.
And that's why the platform, because the platform seems neutral. It's actually a foundation, a good platform. Well, if somebody's on this, they're in the library, they must be okay.
They're reading a book.
Right. If they're at the school, they must be okay.
But this is, this is why cities need to ban this.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, Christians. The point is, and Jonathan Merritt played off of this because he's such a snake.
Yeah,
he did this with us. He's a snake. He's slippery.
They're disgusted.
Christians are disgusted. Now, here's the thing.
And we should be.
He's playing off of an ambiguity. Yeah. Now, on the one hand, is coming into contact with sexual perversion and sin, does it defile a Christian? No. It doesn't. Right. It doesn't. Right. There's uncleanness isn't spread that way.
Paul said you can't get totally out of the world.
No, you can't.
Jesus wasn't defiled by the touch of leopards.
No, exactly. And neither are Christians. We have the Holy Spirit.
That's right.
Which means that if God gives you the opportunity to minister to a transgender person or a crossdresser or a drag queen, then minister the gospel of grace to them.
Yes.
Right.
Boldly.
Right.
And do not be afraid of them defiling you. But here's the thing. What they are doing is disgusting.
Right.
What they are doing is perversion. It is abomination. And we are to guard our children from that.
Yeah.
Amen.
Here's the deal is I liked how you kind of described it, how they're slowly normalizing the issue.
Right.
But this is what happens with us in our own hearts. We slowly normalize small sins.
Well, that's
us,
why it's out here.
And that's why it gets big.
But that's why we failed when we normalized fornication.
That's exactly
right. When we normalized pornography.
Right.
There used to be things on our books called obscenity laws.
Right.
Freedom of speech is not freedom to pervert the public square.
Right.
Because
the public square isn't neutral.
The public square, in order for it to be truly free, and this goes back to the David French Ahmari thing, is you can't have a neutral public square for long.
You have to have virtue.
You have to have virtue, and you have to have certain moral norms.
Yep.
And so when you allow prostitution to be legalized, when you allow sodomy parades, you know, this is whatever, gay pride month.
Yeah. Right.
Every time a parade is walked down the street, what they're doing is normalizing sodomy.
Yeah.
And they are grooming our children.
What?
And they are an abomination. If you go back and you read about this in the Old Testament, abomination, strictly speaking, is something that defiles the land.
Right.
Now it is true that in Christ, we're not under the same, cleanliness laws.
Yeah.
And the land is now not just the promised land. It's now the whole world. But by reasoning from analogy, there are certain kinds of sins, certain kinds of sexual perversions in particular that defile cultures.
That's right. Right.
And they defile them by normalizing perversion.
Yeah. Right.
And it is harmful for society.
Yeah. And my point is we got to be taking care of the little sins in our heart. Yeah. We got to stop normalizing some of the small things that go on.
This happens when people watch Friends.
And this
right when you're watching Friends, you're getting conditioned. Yeah. You're being groomed.
Yeah. Will and grace.
Yeah, whatever. Your little crack cocaine habit is.
Yeah.
What one of the
of perversion.
I was really bothered by they just want to give back to their community. That sounds like a really fun line, but that's exactly what we should be afraid of.
Right.
Right.
The thing that they want to give us back is the perversion that we don't need, right?
This is like somebody saying, I want to just run my sewer into the street.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, you can't do that.
Don't give back to the community that.
When you share your perversion like that, you are defiling the community.
Absolutely.
It is not good for the public good at all. And Christians need to just say that and say, no, you may not pervert our children.
But
and we can't let them create the culture, and we can't let them dictate what's allowed.
Right.
Right. They're policing us.
Right.
And we're letting them police us. And this is what happened with, let me turn this. This is what happened with Louder with Crowder is he got demonetized.
Yeah.
So that now you got all these liberal organizations policing us and telling us what's okay and what's not. And they're demonetizing our platforms. Yeah. And then the Pinterest guy, I don't know if you guys saw this, Pinterest, Live Action News, the pro-life organization, Pinterest had put them in a bucket along with pornography to blacklist these
so they wouldn't
pornography
show up in
websites
lists and, exactly. and search lists and stuff like that
exactly and so this whistleblower came out
so an employee of Pinterest saw that
found this out
and exposed
it went to Veritas Veritas project and he was interviewed they changed his voice and everything but of course Pinterest found out who was the employee
okay
and they fired that employee
oh yeah because they practice church discipline
right. yeah that's yeah. right
but unlike Christians right. This is why Christians are losing because you're not disciplining your pastor whose children are disobedient.
Oh, man.
Because the kid in the youth group is sleeping with the girl or whatever.
Either you discipline your people well or liberals are going to be disciplining you.
Yeah. And what you're doing, though, is you're assuming a center.
Yeah.
Well, and part of the
discipline. You want a word in here?
Well, maybe a little bit.
Do you want a word?
Hey, y'all gotten so comfortable.
You should be around. You should stick around.
Yeah.
Keep talking.
Aaron coming up, by the way.
No, what about Hunger Games 2020?
Stop
the whole movie.
New in Hunger Games.
It is time to walk
had to get
away
that in
from the politics of the past and towards something.
He tried to hunt it last time.
People
it was tearing
up for food. That's a good thing.
I'm a hugger, I'm a kisser, and I'm a little bit of a sniffer.
Raising the minimum wage does not hurt business, it grows business.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
I am Spartacus.
Don't do that.
So good. So Joe Biden, we got to update everybody on the Democrat Hunger Games 2020 here. Joe Biden promised this last week that he's going to cure cancer. If you vote me in as president, I'm going to cure cancer.
So if we don't, will cancer not be cured?
Yeah.
Oh, if Joe has anything to say about
this is dumb.
The government, Democrats promising more. And then Bernie Sanders, this is crazy to me. Bernie Sanders, he's slipping in the polls. I think I'm...
finally.
Yeah. I think he's, he's run his shtick and it's inflating now, or deflating.
Yeah, we would call that deflating.
Deflating. And he came out with his economic bill of rights. So he's a Democrat socialist. He doubled down on it again last week. And now he came out with his economic bill of rights and the right to a decent job that pays a living wage, the right to quality health care, the right to complete education, the right to affordable housing, the right to clean environment, the right to a secure retirement. That's his economic. Whenever, so the Bill of Rights originally were telling the government, hey,
what you couldn't do.
You can't do this.
It was limiting the government to make people free.
And now Bernie's Bill of Rights is saying, hey, here's what the government's going
to
do for you.
Here's
what we're guaranteeing.
Well, everybody else on the other side, they just lost all their rights.
Yeah.
So now I lost the right to charge what I want to for an employee. Okay. Yeah. This is how much I'm going to pay you. We've lost the right to negotiate. Yeah. The employee can't even say, you know what? That's you don't even have to pay me that much. Right. I'll do this job for this. We can't negotiate and have freedom in our own
business. This is socialism. It guarantees rights for some and rights and others lose.
Yeah, it's like
this is what it is.
It's
socialism. This is what socialism does.
It codifies
losers.
Right. Well, the irony, of course, is that in saying that they will provide all of these things, they are guaranteeing that they won't.
Right.
Because they're trying to command them to come out of thin air.
That's right.
Like Where do these things come from? Where do decent jobs and living wages, healthcare, complete education, housing, where do they come from? They come from people working hard to provide these things.
The cure for cancer.
Right.
It comes from freedom.
It comes from people having the freedom to do this.
That's right. Somebody, and this is what's amazing. Built inside of capitalism proper, built inside of that is natural love for your neighbor.
Right.
When you build something, you have to think about it working in order to be successful.
You have to think about if other people will buy this.
If I make a tire and the tire is falling off, people stop buying my product because I'm not loving my neighbor.
It's not good for them. It's not good for them.
And so I lose money on that. So I have to be concerned about the other person and what I'm making. I want good product to work for them.
And socialism says that you must not care about other people.
That's right.
And I'm going to take your money. I'm going to force you to work. And you have to do this for the government.
That's right. If you don't do what I say.
Right.
Then you won't get the cure for cancer.
It's institutionalized envy and covetousness.
Yeah. And Thomas Sowell's got some great literature on Sowell. Yeah, on socialism. He's got a number of examples on Russia and what the assembly line did to Russia and everything. There's some really.
And George Gilder brought this up when we talked to him as well on the show. But the other thing is that this depends upon men being men. Men have to stop being weasels and wimps. And saying, you know, I want easy money. I want easy food. I want easy stuff.
Yeah.
No, you're a man. You are made to work hard and provide for those around you. The government is going to continue to be bloated like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So long as men don't have backbones and aren't willing to work and provide for their families.
So we're going to talk to Tom Askell and those guys in the third segment. But one of the things that I walked away from the SBC thinking about was I don't have enough ambition for the kingdom of God. And this goes back to your comment for manhood.
That's why you're voting at the SBC.
No. I repent. I vote.
I think it was a couple weeks ago we were talking about the prophet. Like, if you had hit the ground more.
Yeah. Yeah.
You would have been more victorious.
The prophet comes to the king and says, we're going to go. You're going to go fight this battle. Strike the ground with the arrow. And he strikes it like two times or three times. Why didn't you strike it five times or six times? Yeah. You would have completely obliterated
it. And this goes back to masculinity. I feel like sometimes, especially for me, my kids are doing better than I did.
Yeah.
My parents did better than them. And so we find this place of complacency.
Like, this is good enough.
And this is good enough.
Better than it was before.
But we don't think about, hey, what if we take the castle?
Yeah.
What if we take the kingdom? And I'm thinking to myself, I don't have enough ambition for the kingdom of God. Right. I am comfortable with saying, well, we're doing better than what my parents were doing.
Right.
But it's like, that's only striking the ground three times.
Right. Yeah.
I need to have some ambition as a man and say, what can be the best thing for the kingdom and for my family? God, what is it you're going to give me to take?
Yeah.
Yeah. How about city councils that proclaim Jesus
Come
is Lord?
Come on now.
Well, right? But that Wascom actually needs to strike the ground. This is their time to strike more. Right. Right.
They've created a sanctuary city. Why?
Strike more.
They need to say in Jesus'
Amen.
Name.
Amen.
That we need a public square that is truly free.
Yep.
Amen.
But it's only truly free if it's under the lordship of Jesus Christ. That's not a theocracy. It's not making everybody go to church on Sunday. Yeah.
That's actually giving people freedom. That's true.
It's saying within these norms, Ten Commandments norms, you can be free.
Mm. Aaron Wren, next up on Cross Politic. And you don't want to miss the third segment. We're going to talk SBC with Tom Askell.
Are you going to vote again?
I'm going to try and save this for the next year.
Yeah, I see if they'll let you. After this show. Flasco Conversations supports homeschooling parents by cultivating the love of learning through a Christian worldview in fellowship with other families. We provide a classical, Christ-centered curriculum, local, like-minded communities across the United States and in several countries, and we train parents who are striving to be great classical educators in the home. For more information and to get connected, please visit our website at classicalconversations.com. Classical, Christian, get connected, get community. Welcome back to Cross Politic on the Fight Laugh Feast Network. We are very grateful to have with us on the line for this segment, Mr. Aaron M. Wren. He's a writer and researcher on urban and economic development and infrastructure policy. He is also a regular contributor and is cited by national and global media outlets. His work has appeared in The Guardian, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many others. He is also the founder and author of, I believe it's a monthly newsletter called The Masculinist.
That thing is loaded.
Thanks so much for joining us, Aaron.
thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. So you got on the map, I think. I mean, at least I first heard about you because of your work with The Masculinist. So can you just describe for us, what is The Masculinist and why did you start it?
Basically, The Masculinist is intended to be the Christian antidote to Jordan Peterson and all the deep things out there on the internet. It's a personal project. And what I really noticed was not just Jordan Peterson, but all of these various online men's guru types, Joe Rogan, Stefan Molyneux, the pickup artists, etc., were all attracting. Jordan Peterson's probably one of the healthiest of the bunch. Were basically attracting hordes and hordes and hordes of young men. At the same time, the church is about, depending on what survey you read, 60% female, 40% male, and pastors routinely voice their frustration at trying to attract men, particularly single men. And so there seemed to be a big disconnect between what these secular guys were doing that was being very successful, in a sense successful from a market perspective, although false theologically, and what the church is doing, which may have had the truth of the gospel, but in many ways just wasn't being effective. And so I wanted to engage in that to see what we could do to turn that around in the church and to get in the game with men.
So why is Joe Rogan more effective than the church on this, on drawing men into his circle of influence?
Yeah, well, Rogan in particular, I'm not as familiar. I watched a couple of his interviews.
Or Jordan Peterson, for interesting. That matter. Yeah.
Yeah, Jordan Peterson, what I find interesting about both of those guys is they got their start really building up huge audiences with extremely long YouTube videos.
That's right.
Joe Rogan interview can last 2.5 hours.
Yep.
You go out to Jordan Peterson's YouTube and people have like 2-hour lectures on Genesis. That's right. And you're like, people are watching hundreds of thousands and even into the millions of people are watching this. And I'm like, what's going on?
Like a Mark Driscoll sermon.
yeah, exactly. Well, what you see is, they're going deep into things. They're speaking to things that are very relevant to men. And particularly with Jordan Peterson and with all these guys, they try to create what I call news you can use. They're trying to essentially practically help men to improve in life, not always in a godly way. For example, the pickup artists want to help you have lots of casual sex. That would be a very evil thing to improve at.
Right.
But nevertheless, their idea is we're going to help you improve at these things. And they come at it with a sense of not in a judgmental way towards the men. They are kind of meeting them where they are, so to speak.
They're like dads.
I'm a guy like you. We all need to improve, but here's how we get there. And there could be some tough messaging, but unlike sort of the brutal beatdowns that Mark Driscoll used to give or that many of these church people give, they were actually focused on how to build you up. Another thing that they're all, you notice a lot of these guys do, is they manufacture conflict. And they do that in order to want to attract attention to themselves and also to sort of credentialize themselves as kind leaders. Of manly guys. Uh-huh. And a lot of times they do it in a very controlled context, so that they're going to come away looking good.
Yeah.
But they all like to have conflict like that. Jordan Peterson Channel 4 interview that went viral on the internet in the UK.
We had him scheduled on the show after that interview, and he really blew up, and he canceled the interview after that.
Well, same thing. Ben Shapiro, the right wing political guy, he used to travel around the campuses, and all these protesters would show up on his campuses. So he's like, I'm going to go into the lion's den.
Right.
I'm going to demonstrate that I'm willing to go into these hostile environments, and people see that and they're attracted to it and they're drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is this sense of setting themselves up as a sort of guru and an avatar of something, which is not something that I personally want to do. That's not part of my mission for myself, but I think that's part of the attractiveness that they have. And frankly, they're just giving out better information than the church is on a lot of topics. I always like to contrast what the church teaches men that women are attracted to versus what these internet gurus teach. You know, the church will say, well, you know, women are attracted to servant leaders. They want this godly man who's, you know, loving them, affirming them, who's like a really nice guy, you know, super conscientious, spends lots of time playing with the kid, takes care of the home, etc. Jordan Peterson says, women are attracted to men who win status competitions with other men. Yeah. And I'm like, well, which one of those is more accurate? Well, clearly Jordan Peterson. And I think the fact that the church has given so much bad information on such a primal subject is one of the things that has really turned men off on the church. And you know, when you turn to these guys and they start giving you information like that, you go, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Why didn't anybody else ever tell me that?
Right. So Aaron, just like in a nutshell, you've got an article, I mean, a newsletter called The Masculinist. So what does it mean to be a man?
Well, that's a great question. And it varies, you know, from culture to culture. But a guy named David Gilmore wrote a great book called Manhood in the Making, where he looked at different cultures around the world, you know, often in kind of primitive tribal cultures, but also from advanced parts of the advanced world, all over the place, China, Spain, you know, Pacific Islands. And he tried to distill the common aspects of masculinity. And you can actually find a great précis of this on the Art of Manliness website. Brett McKay there did a huge multi-part summary of this book.
Okay.
But basically it boils down to three main categories of things that men have always been judged by. The first is sort of protection, if you will, you know, being physically strong, courageous, going into battle, being able to handle pain, being willing to sacrifice oneself for the tribe, etc. A second would be provision, which is acquiring resources, not just for, you know, your own wife and kids, but generating a surplus bounty for your community, for your tribe. And then the third one is essentially procreation, having lots of kids, being able to sexually please a woman, etc. So that sort of sense of virility, of being the warrior and of being able to build up the community through provision are sort of the same things. And there's a lot of other things that have gone into that. Men are expected to be out in the public square, in the arena, striving to compete and achieve. Taking on danger and risk. They have to earn their status. It's not just something that you fall into. Maintaining a sense of autonomy. So these are a lot of the things that, from various societal perspectives have gone into making a man. And many of which today I think we've tamed a lot.
Mm-hmm. How do you square that with biblical manhood? Do you look at this list and say, yep, that's biblical manhood? Or do you want to add a few more things to that? How would you answer that same question as a Christian?
Yeah. Well, I would say a lot of that is very consistent with the Bible. I would say some of the secular non-Christian cultures have expressed those in negative directions, but I think this is very consistent with manhood. I think one of the things that has happened in the church is there's essentially been a denial of the vocation of manhood as a vocation. If you look at even the most conservative Christians in the Protestant circles, the one that would call themselves complementarianisms, I believe, you know,
sure,
men and women have different roles. They essentially limit it, practically speaking, to only the explicit proof texts that are in the Bible, you know, Ephesians 5 or
right,
Peter 3 or whatever. And so they essentially limit the vocation of manhood to the home and to the church.
Right.
And outside of those environments, we're essentially in a purely androgynous environment.
Mm.
Whereas I think you could read, and you know, one of the things in my newsletter, I don't like to get into theology because I'm not a theologian. I'm a cultural critic. I always stress that. That's the genre I'm working in.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But you know, for me, when I read the Bible, I think a book like 2 Timothy is one of the great treatises on manhood.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's rarely preached that way.
Huh.
in the church.
Because Paul's writing to
his... Paul's writing, essentially writing this to his son.
Right.
He's modeling out the characteristics. I mean, what is he telling him? He's saying, look, you need to be strong, Timothy.
Right.
You need to elevate your game. You need to get more serious.
Yeah.
You need to cleanse yourself from unrighteousness. You need to hold fast to the truth. You need to pursue your mission. Yep. You need to endure hardship.
You better preach, Aaron.
Like, by the way, that's what I'm doing in prison right now.
Yeah, right.
And come on.
Those are the messages.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah. But so why is
even the analogies he uses in there? You know, the soldier, the farmer,
right?
The boxer, the athlete. Yeah. Those were quintessentially masculine archetypes of that era.
So why is masculinity so important for politics then? Why do we need men in politics?
Well, traditionally politics has been an almost entirely male domain. I don't like to get into this thing where we start saying about, if we just had a more masculine politics, everything would be okay. I think masculinity and many of the characteristics of masculinity are things that can be applied in both positive ways and in negative ways. So I think we can recognize that there are people who embody manhood in many respects who are nevertheless, through sin, just through the very nature of being a sinful human being.
Sure.
Are deploying that way. You think about, a Tony Soprano, for example.
Who?
You know,
I'm a Christian, yeah. Aaron. I don't know who you're talking about.
yeah, exactly. I think that when it comes to essentially men in politics, masculinity per se, particularly in the modern era, often tends to, I don't want to overly say it like, oh, what we need to do to fix our politics is just make it more masculine. I don't necessarily agree with that.
Would you agree though?
Clearly politics at the highest levels have continued to be very male dominated.
Is it better though, all things being equal, to have godly men leading a country?
Well, we certainly prefer godly men to ungodly men, but we also have to consider, right, that there are other domains of that. You actually have to be competent, as well. And so a lot of times, someone could be a very godly person and yet be totally incompetent.
Sure.
In their position, and so I think those are things to look at. It's not just although godliness is the most important thing, you also have to be competent at it.
Aaron, one thing that was really interesting when I signed up for the Masculinist, one of the things that I thought was I joined a secret society. Because it was
this old school Drudge Report email list.
Yeah, it wasn't like it was easy to find. It was kind of tucked behind a back door. You had to know somebody to be able to get in. Is it still the case?
Well, it's online. You can go to aaronoren.com/masculinist and get it. I did run it as an email list intentionally. One reason being, people like the Washington Post have figured out that if they just give op-ed columns to different Christians, they'll just put each other on blast. And essentially, there's been this war between all these different tribes of Christians beating each other up, essentially in the secular media. I didn't really think that was a good look. And so I had some strong critiques to make, but I kind of wanted to make them as much as possible, within the Christian world. And I also was not looking to set myself up as a celebrity either. But yes, this is dangerous knowledge. Be careful with this knowledge. And yes, it is an email list. It's a little bit under the radar, if you will.
So I want to go back to talking about the Joe Rogans and the Jordan Peterson stuff that he was talking about earlier. So Aaron, connect the dots a little bit for us. This is, you've got the Jordan Peterson phenomenon going on, the Joe Rogan, I don't know, the Crowder, I don't, these other big name conservative / I don't know, secular masculinists, if you will.
Preachers.
Preachers. How has that affected public discourse? How has that affected our politics?
Well, I think it's interesting. We are in a, you know, maybe in a more agonistic age, if you will, where our politics is more in your face. It's more combative. It's not just on the right. You got, you know, Chapo's Trap House. You got the Young Turks.
Yeah.
You got people like that. And frankly, it's not just men. If you go on the internet or elsewhere, you know, woke women are very aggressive as well.
Yeah.
So I just think that we do have a more aggressive, in-your-face style today. We're kind of a little bit in a disintegrating era. There's very low institutional, declining institutional trust. A lot of the things that we thought we knew turned out we didn't really know them. And so I think as things are sort of breaking apart a little bit, some of the old rules are breaking down and things are becoming much, much more combative. And, you know, maybe it'll stay that way for a while. I don't really see, you know, a return to, you know, high trust government, for example, where, for again, it doesn't seem to be it. Because first off, I mean, and the reality is, some of this just comes from we're just in a society where we're lower trust because legitimately we should be extending lower trust.
Yeah.
20% of all the people riding the bus in New York City don't pay the fare. Mm. Think about all those people who are bribing their way into elite colleges.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just the tip. That's just the tip of the iceberg. You know, they didn't realize like rich people actually can essentially just make a donation to get their kid in. Yeah. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal that in these affluent high school district, in these affluent school districts, 30%, as many as 30% of the kids are getting extra time on their exams because they're saying they're disabled, which is, you know, an insanely high percentage. So we clearly see that large percentages now of the population are just gaming and exploiting the system. You know, we've got, you know, what was it, Theranos and all these things. So with all these scams out there, it's creating a system in which people just are losing trust, and now it's becoming much more of a war. It's less about trusting the process and more about fighting it out. And so I think that that's I don't know that that's necessarily about men or women or whatever. I think it's just the nature of our kind of disintegrating disintegrating age.
But if masculinity is what you described earlier, a one of protection, militants, defense, and so forth. And if there are Christian analogies to that, if that's consistent with the biblical calling of the vocation of men, or go back to 2 Timothy, where Paul is urging Timothy and pastors and preachers and elders in particular to fight the good fight of faith, how does a godly man, a Christian man, a preacher, a pastor, an elder, How does he fight in an age, an agonistic age, a militant age? I mean, how do you respond?
Well, one of the things I think that's very clear with all these guys is people are drawn to others who are not afraid to stand at their ground and speak the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the great lessons of Donald Trump, you know, for all the legitimate things that people say about it. What people were so drawn to were Donald Trump. I did interviews. I did a great podcast with my father about this. You know, they did, you know, focus groups in different places. And is that the thing people keep saying is people admire someone who will stand their ground.
Right.
Yep.
And not just, oh, apologize, just try to nuance everything. Yeah, that was like that Channel 4 interview with Jordan Peterson. He stood his ground.
Right.
And I think just this idea, you know, Jordan Peterson's probably a better example because he doesn't have the boorish behavior that a certain someone often exhibits.
Yeah.
But he's like, look, I'm not here to attack you. I'm not trying to attack you, but this is what's true. This is what I believe. These are the facts. And I'm going to stand firm on that. Yeah. And I think I always keep coming back to what Paul said in Acts when he said, I have not shunned to declare unto you the whole counsel of God.
Yeah.
He said, look, I told you the whole thing. I told it to you straight.
Yeah.
You know, and just holding my ground and not trying to, because you can just see, I mean, I just think so often, you can almost see the fear and many of these pastors as they pick every single word so carefully.
Oh,
boy.
Wow.
You ain't lying. It must be, you know, And I say that as someone, I'm like, you know, this is the law of projection, right? Whatever we see in other people's things, we should be looking at uh-huh. ourselves. I mean, I'm sort of the same way.
Come on.
Right? I'm not someone who likes to be in people, you know, in people's faces.
Yeah.
You know? And so I like to be liked. I don't like to be in conflict. I would right. prefer we all just got along.
Yeah, we.
But, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, it doesn't come to that.
Yeah, that's right.
Prefer the praise of man.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
To pleasing God.
Right. Aaron Wren, AaronWren.com. Did I say that right?
Yes.
AaronWren.com. Hey, yeah. Sign up for the Masculinist.
Yeah. Be part of a secret society.
Man, it's so such great content. Aaron, yeah. thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next on Cross Politics, talking about guys who stand up. Tom Askell and Jared Longshore are going to talk about what happened just
at the past SBC.
Week at the SBC.
SBC yeah. coming up next.
Ooh, need some masculinity.
Toby didn't know that. He's like, oh, they're coming
yeah.
on.
Yeah. yeah.
More Cross Politics next. If you need a little red meat in your diet, Pastor Doug Wilson.
One of the things we must come to grips with is the fact that eschatology precedes everything. The last things come first, just like Jesus said. So the first thing we need to get hold of is the idea that the whole discussion is a matter of interpretive ideas in conflict, not an interpretive idea on one side and the facts on the other. God is telling a story, and we are that many more chapters closer to the eucatastrophic denouement of his story.
To enjoy more red meat of this kind, check out the podcast on iTunes, or for more blogging of this particular nature, blog and Mayblog at DougWills.com. Kind of sticks in your teeth, don't it?
Are you recording this time?
I am recording this time. Ooh. It's out hey, of practice.
Tom and Jerry, we're we'll recording.
Yeah!
Oh, that's great, Jared.
Oh, man. Welcome back to Cross Politic on the Fight Left Beast Network. As you can tell, we have some additional troublemakers
on
this last segment. Oh my goodness, he just did that thing that you did.
Yes.
And, oh my goodness.
That's how you do a cowboy yell, Gabe.
You landed it, brother.
We got Man. With us pastors Tom Askell, Jared Longshore. They are out of Florida. I can't remember the name of your church. Grace?
Grace Baptist Church.
What is it?
Grace Baptist Church.
I got it, Grace.
He only knows the podcast, Sword in the Trial.
That's... Sword in the Trial, though, hosts there. And really, guys, seriously, you cannot take Chocolate Knox away like that for a whole week.
They can lucky we gave him back.
No, y'all can't wait to get rid of me.
Next time, when you guys take him for a whole week, you got to pay me and Toby also.
Oh my god!
We get some reparations over here across Baltic.
Oh man!
Oh man!
You got your surgeon.
Oh man!
Oh pastor, I'm hard. It's hard hearing. You got to find a spot for me.
Oh man!
Otherwise, Jared's gonna have to speak for you this whole show, and you know you don't want that.
I like being his mouthpiece, though.
I don't even know what happened. There was a Southern Baptist Convention
this last week.
This last week. And mm-hmm. and what happened?
We got rowdy on a number of levels.
Yeah. Sorry, take it, Chuck.
I'm getting introduced to this world, to the SBC world. Right. I've known Southern Baptist, but I haven't known like the diehard how the world operates. And I don't think
the
politics of it and how the whole thing operates. So I was like, this was better than watching CNN or C-SPAN or a presidential election. This was better than all of that stuff. And so part of me just wants to skip right past the first part of this and kind of go to it. Man, there's so much going on, but so they had these at the end of it. We're at the end of the conference and there's these, what was it? 13 resolutions, Pastor?
That's correct.
13 resolutions that I guess everybody votes on.
Okay.
And so it was interesting because they got these, I actually have one of these right here. Look at that.
He told us that he got to vote at your SBC.
I second a few motions. Yeah.
I can neither confirm nor deny. I'm doing a more two-step.
I just think it's funny that that Knox can't come to the Lord's table in your church, but he can vote.
I can come to the table.
Denomination.
I can come to the table. They're not racist. So, okay. So, all right. So, Pastor Askell, kind of walk me through the point where the committee gets up to talk about the last resolutions and kind of what happened.
And this is the one on critical race theory?
Critical race theory is number 9 on the resolution. But what happened, everybody's talking about the story of what happened, but not how it happened. So okay. I was intrigued by how it happened because I'd never seen anything like this before.
Okay.
So Pastor Gasser,
well, go ahead. We have a committee on resolutions. It's appointed by the president, and the president's J.D. Greer. So he appointed this committee a couple of months ago. And any Southern Baptist that's going to be at the convention can submit a resolution that will be considered by the committee. And I forget how many they said they had. It wasn't that many. I was surprised, like 18 or 20 or something. Usually there's more than that. And they dismissed several of them and decided to come out with 13. Now, I was led to believe that, okay, you had 13 submitted resolutions that were going to be put before the convention. So the committee has the right to edit anything that they get. They have the right to produce their own resolutions as well. Okay. So then they can originate resolutions.
Okay.
And the first 8 resolutions had, you know, a debate about it. I've been told by 2 different former chairmen of that committee that typically what they try to do is arrange the way the resolutions are rolled out so that you have ample time to discuss those that you know are going to be somewhat debatable.
Okay.
Well, there was a lot of conversation about the first 8. We get to number 9. Now, again, get this. This is the last session. Everybody's tired. It's dinner time. A lot of people are already gone. And the president of the convention, who is the moderator, J.D. Greer, stands up and says, we're going to bundle these next 4 resolutions, numbers 9 through 13, and just vote on them all at once.
Okay, Pastor, pause right there.
Well,
pause right there.
Okay.
Because, listen, I've been waiting from, I've got 3 cameras ready. I got Pastor Askel mic'd up. I'm sitting down, and I've been waiting for the opportunity to hit record on all my cameras, okay? So I'm excited. I get up from my seat right as J.D. Greer says this, and I turn with the quickness, a whip of my head. I still hurt right here on my left side of my neck when he said that, because everything that I've been waiting to film just got canceled.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
But I also hear in my ear that stirs my soul a huge yell from Pastor Thomas says, no!
Really?
He yells it out.
He yelled?
Yells.
Wow.
From the floor. And throws his hands up. No! What did you say? Like aborted or something like that? Like amend? What you gave? You yelled out something to change the, making a change on that. No, we're not going to do it. It's not fair. We got to vote. We got to do it.
I said freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. Was there
blue paint on his face?
Yeah, you know, amazingly, it's like he just wiped his face and blue paint just flew on there. Okay. It was amazing. So go ahead. Now you can go. I gotta set that part up.
Yeah, no, I did because my microphone was not hot at that point, and I'm some significant distance from the platform, and so I wanted to be heard. I wasn't trying to be rude. Right. I was just trying to be heard.
Right.
To say no. As I understand it, Robert's Rules of Order, that if one messenger, one participant protests that type of decision, the chair has no alternative except to rule that, okay, we won't do that.
Okay.
So they discussed that back and forth and then decided that they went over all of the last 4. So does anybody want to amend or speak against any of these? Well, there were people who wanted to speak to against or amend all of them.
Yeah.
So they had to take them in order. But now we're out of time that has been allotted for the business session. So there has to be the allocation of more time. So that has to be a vote set before the messengers for just 10 minutes was all it's proposed, which, again, that could have been 20 minutes, could have been 30 minutes. And then, you know, if you only need 10, we go home early.
Yeah.
But 10 minutes was what was allotted. And Resolution 9 then was taken up. So that's kind of the process that got us to that point during the day. Now, there's a longer process that preceded this. This Resolution 9, I learned Thursday morning after the commission closed that this was actually a resolution submitted by a pastor from California. Mm. And the resolution he submitted, which he called On Critical Race Theory and Intersectionality, which is his very name that was given to the resolution that came out of committee, was almost 180 degrees opposed to the resolution that was submitted to the messengers.
Wow.
So again, the committee has the right to take an amend, but whereas the original proposal from this pastor said things like, this is a, you know, these are godless ideologies and these come from Marxist worldviews and things. All of that language is cut. And whereas I don't know that he said anything or much of anything about these ideologies being used as analytical tools, that was the bulk of what was said, in addition to all the clarifications and warnings about sufficiency of scripture, and most of that, anything throughout scripture, all that was in the resolution itself as it came out. But it was stark. And when I began to hear this might be the case, I started investigating it, and I was able to find the pastor that submitted the original. And he sent me his original. And when I read that, it became obvious, or at least it seems obvious to me, that that's what had happened. So that's a whole other backstory. That as it is dribbled out over the last day or so, people are upset about it. And I can understand why, because it does look like it's at least been a mishandling of things by the resolution committee. But, you know, they're under pressure. I'm sure they did the best they could.
Sure. So, I mean, obviously, if you're on the committee, and if I don't know the guy who was the chair of the committee. Wasn't Curtis?
Curtis Woods.
Man, he looks like a sharp dude. And I think he understands where the SBC is and what's going on with the SBC. And so I don't think he's ignorant of the fact that this was going to be a hard. And you guys, I'm not speaking for you on this. I'm speaking just from what my observation is from an outsider. It seems like he would know that, to me, what the temperature of the SBC is, and that it would be good. Man, let's deal with this first, get this out the way, and to move on to this, move on to something else. And so he seems like a guy who would know things like that. But one of the things that bothered me about watching this event, it wasn't just what happened there that moment at the close of it. It was what was happening, and I was observing happening throughout the whole conference. Having a chance to be in the back seat and watching you guys engage, I kept seeing more and more guys who I know and trust and who are sound and biblical guys. One, that they weren't being biblical or sound. I even heard presidents of large seminaries saying that they weren't aware or haven't been engaged as much with the topic of what's going on, and just not speaking up like men on the topic. And I saw way more fleeing from engagement than I saw engaging. And it bothered me because what right now it seems like it's the issues. The church has always faced issues. The church is always called to vigilance, because every era that we've had problems in the church, it doesn't matter what it is, we're going to have issues.
Right.
And so that's nothing new. Critical race theory is nothing new. It's just another thing that the churches have to face. But when men don't stand up to be men in that moment, that's when those things become a problem.
Yeah.
And so
yeah, but there's a lot of reasons for that not to happen in the SBC, Knox. That's a sad day, but that's the case.
So
if you stand up, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
If you stand up and say something like, hey, I'm going to talk about the warrior king motif, like Owen Strand of Midwestern Seminary did at our conference.
Yeah.
He got raked all over the coals. He's received all kinds of pressure, all kinds of challenges for simply saying, like, I'm going to do the warrior king motif. So there's all kinds of reasons. If you stand up and say something, you're going to be called a rabble rouser because you're talking about an issue that's outside of the Baptist faith and message 2000, our statement of faith. And if you talk about any issues outside of the Baptist faith and message 2000, in which you're going to disagree with somebody else that's in the Southern Baptist Convention, well, that means you're a troublemaker, right? Because we're not allowed to talk about issues outside. So there's a mounting
except Christian for theological. The critical race theory or women pastors,
right?
So hold on, I've not been following this at all.
Yeah.
I was just back here in Moscow, you know,
trying to figure out how to
praying
do a show.
For Knox to come home.
I was praying in precatory prayers against I don't know whoever had my Knox. So help me understand, Pastor Tom. You said okay, Resolution 9, the original one was a lot more hardcore. What got passed was way watered down and just 180 degrees opposite. It sounds like you're saying it's bad. It was terrible. Can you help us understand, like, why, what's so bad about it? I mean, it seems like it says that the Bible is the authority, it's sufficient, it's saying critical race theory and intersectionality is just a helpful tool. So what's the big deal?
Yeah, well, I don't want to suggest that what is in the resolution as it came out and was adopted is horrible. I mean, it says true things, okay, and it says good things. So if I were to take it and just parse it line by line, I don't know that there's anything in here significant that I have any significant disagreement with. So in one sense, it's not so much what it says, it's what it does.
Okay.
Or I could say it's the implications that are given by the way it says what it says. And this was illustrated and confirmed for me by Dr. Wood's response to my amendment when I offered it and asked that it be received as a friendly amendment. Mm-hmm. And he refused. The committee takes this as an unfriendly amendment. And then he said, because it's the aspiration of this committee to show that that critical race theory and intersectionality are simply analytical tools. Well, they are not simply analytical tools. They are analytical tools, but they are also ideologies birthed out of worldviews that are godless, that are Marxist. And so you start using the tools that come from that worldview. Well, can you do that as a Christian and not fall into Marxism and godlessness? Yeah, sure you can. But you're going to be very, very dangerously led. It'd be easy for you to be led astray if you're not conscious about what you're doing.
Yeah,
that's what's so shocking about this. About this, that this amendment did not pass. Toby is, you know, I know Curtis. He's a friend. He's up there on the platform. We've talked about critical race theory a number of times together. And I was trying to stand up on the microphone after Tom and speak for the amendment. But the way the process goes, somebody got to speak for it before me, and then when they called on me, it had to be somebody speaking against the amendment.
Okay.
And some guy rolled up on me and kind of body checked me off the mic and said he wanted to speak against
it. He was a little bitty guy.
Somebody can body check you, Jerry?
Was there a picture of
he
that?
He kind of gave me a little check. I love him. I wasn't going to let him take that mic until the moderator told me to back up. So okay. I kind of stood there. But anyways, what I wanted to say is, look, to Curtis, I know you, you're my brother, we're friends, we talk about these things, but we absolutely have to mark that critical theory is a theory. It is a worldview. It is an ideology. It is not merely an analytical tool. This is what Albert Mohler has clearly said. I know he would stand in agreement with this amendment that was made. This is the same thing that Neil Shinvey has been saying online.
Right.
It is a worldview antithetical to Christianity. And then, sadly, Curtis did say that we don't really have time to get into the origins or the ideology, but there's a book by Richard Delgado that's very easily accessible online for free. Delgado is one of the leading critical theorists right now. He cites very clearly, and I was put onto this book by Curtis and by Jarvis Williams at Southern Seminary, another man who has been talking about critical theory a lot.
Yeah.
And I read it, and Delgado says right off the bat, critical theory is built upon radical feminism and the postmodernism of Derrida.
Yeah.
And it's not a fallacy of origin either. People have been saying that. It's not a fallacy of origin if there's a modern leading critical theorist who says critical theory is built upon.
Yeah.
Built upon.
Right.
That means you take away those postmodern godless ideologies. He says it's built upon Gramsci.
Yeah.
So, right. Yeah. I'm trying to stand there. I wanted to speak, didn't have an opportunity to speak because of time, but I was like, this convention should know that we are about to neglect to acknowledge what critical theory and intersectionality are. We're calling them merely tools. And let's just get, and this is where Tom also is not just trying to smack this down and be a meanie pants.
He
was willing to amend it. He's a unifier. He's like, okay, if this is where we're at, I'm willing to battle. But listen, we have to mark that this is a worldview. We have to mark the origins of this. And I'm shocked that Southern Baptists have now rejected that amendment.
In the resolution, it actually says we denounce the misuse of critical race theory and intersectionality.
Did they define it, though?
So basically what they're denouncing, though, they're just saying if you misuse it, yeah, it can cause problems. But if you use it correctly.
Yeah.
Then it can be helpful.
So that's part of my question. What happens if Southern Baptists start using critical race theory as analytical tool? What's the outcome of that?
I would say, okay.
the Jehovah Witness worldview and theology. Can you understand that, acknowledge what it is, and then use it as an analytical tool to understand the J-dub that knocks on your door? Yeah, by all means you can. But what's going to happen if you don't acknowledge what the J-dub believes and you don't acknowledge the origins of his belief and you just start using it as an analytical tool? So that was the problem with the amendment. They did not acknowledge what it indeed is. Therefore, you're not going to use it well as an analytical tool.
Right, because you don't know what it is.
Now, back to your point, though, about not enough men, not enough strong men. This is your pre-conference, your pre-seminar.
Yeah.
This is what you're talking about,
yeah,
Knox.
Yeah.
So Resolution 10 was about expanding the Selective Service to include women. What happened with that one?
It passed.
So it actually says... Your Resolution 10 says, we honor women who wish to engage in military service as volunteers. So the SBC approves of women in combat.
No, it doesn't say combat.
In service.
There are many places you can serve in military service outside of combat.
So service...
And I think we're on record against combat.
Service is not combat?
No. There's all, if all you have in the military were people who engage in combat, the military would fail miserably.
Oh, sure.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So, but
what if a woman was serving in combat? Would SBC honor it?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Now, I say that. I'm pretty sure we're on record about that. What this is, there's proposals floating around now in D.C. about requiring women to sign up for the draft.
Sure. Yeah. No, I get
so
that.
This is in direct response to that.
No, I got that. I was.
I don't think it's a response. I think it's a.
I was shocked though, but just by the
wading
line,
into the skinny water, this shallow end of the pool.
Yeah, I was just thinking though, in terms of like the bigger picture, if the SBC is honoring women who are going into military combat or on the front lines of police or whatever, then that's another major issue here.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it is, and I'll have to confess that there's no doubt that has not been carefully thought through, and there's no doubt there would be a much greater variety of opinion on that.
Yeah,
and there would need to be some pretty heavy debate on that.
So, what's the chance? Yeah, what's the chance that Beth Moore is the next president of the SBC?
Hmm. Can I answer that? Can I answer that? I want to answer that.
Yeah.
I honestly
don't got to vote. Go ahead.
Yeah, I can actually vote.
You got one of those yellow things.
I don't think, not yet.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I don't think that the SBC is there yet. I think they're working towards it, but I don't think that that's where she would not.
They're just getting groomed for it?
There's a lot that has to happen between, when's the next time they vote on the president next year?
Next year.
Or is it 2 years from now?
One year
from now. Yeah. The Southern Baptists are not there yet. From what I can tell, looking from the outside, I went around with a microphone and Tom's daughter did some
reconnaissance.
She did some reconnaissance for me. I don't think, and just talking to guys, I think they still have some things in place that won't let them go that far. I think there's more of a faction at the top that is kind of pushing for something that Southern Baptists as a whole are not there yet.
Yeah.
But they're working
on it.
And I think that
they're warming up to it.
I think that in some ways, noticing what happened with the critical race theory setup, they are playing on the ignorance of some of the Southern Baptists and sort of the white guilt that they have to move them to a particular position.
Right.
I don't. And Tom, if I'm reading that wrong, Jeff, if I'm reading that wrong, let me know. But I don't think my brothers are there yet.
No, you're right. I would confirm that.
Okay.
I'd agree.
This is one of the challenges about the fight right now is there's a number of sketchy things going on. And most of the convention does not know that. And even most of the Calvinists within the convention are not ready.
That's right.
Are not seeing it form yet. And so the challenge is, it's like, man, you guys are talking about all this need for a fight and we don't see it yet.
Right.
So it's a lot of it is masked under other kinds of things.
One of the things that's been fun for me since January, and since we came down, you guys invited us to the conference that you did in January, the Founders Conference. It's been an interesting thing to watch Pastor Askell and you guys kind of bloom up to engagement.
Yeah.
It's the narrative has been beautiful in watching that and watching Pastor Askell on the floor. But one of the things I heard you say after the resolution passed, Pastor Askell, was that that's okay. That's okay. We're autonomous. We don't have to do nothing they say.
That's what I wanted
to ask. Or something like that.
Yeah.
And so even though that's true, and I think that that's kind of somewhat of the beauty about it, because I watched a lot of guys walk away after the resolution really beat up. I noticed you didn't have that posture. You was like, all right, bet. I'm going to go back to my church and I'm going to preach. I'm going to preach hard and I'm going to keep fighting. But a lot of guys walked away and felt like we just lost the SBC. And so I'm wondering, if you don't have to follow a resolution, what's kind of the point of engaging them?
Yeah. Well, resolutions are not binding in their authority, but they're not unimportant because they are an expression of what the convention felt, believed, decided at that moment.
As a community.
So next year, theoretically, you could make a resolution to just 180 degrees repudiate this one or any other one.
You know, I surely can, Pastor. Yes, I can. I can make it.
You ought to make that motion.
Let me give me in again.
So, I mean, that's the upside of autonomy. I know there's a lot of downsides, but that's the upside of this.
Yeah.
And so there's no reason to be discouraged. I mean, at some point, and I had more people text me last week from even before the convention started, just Monday during the pastor's conference, guys were in the room there.
Yeah.
Saying, I'm done. I'm out. I can't take this anymore. And, you know, that's a conscience issue. And so I have no doubt we'll lose churches over this. And people will say, I'm not going to participate anymore. And obviously, we all have to have those points. And at some point, you got to decide, is this kind of association worth it? There are a lot of good things that can make us say, yeah, it's worth fighting for. We send out thousands of missionaries, and our missionary service corps is getting stronger and healthier. That's good. We still have some good theological education being done in various institutions and agencies. That's a good thing. But if we're going to go this route, I mean, if this resolution is a harbinger of things to come, and we are going to continue to be treated this way by the leadership of the SBC, and this is the narrative that's going to be marshaled forth, I think you're going to see a lot of churches and a lot of pastors who are going to say no more. So my attitude is, okay, guys, we got a lot more work to do.
Yeah.
You know, we've been played. I've got a friend, Mark Barber, who's a sharp pastor, PhD in history. And he said, you know, man, I didn't understand critical race theory. He said, I've just begun to hear about it. He said, I voted for the resolution because I trust the guys on the platform, and I listened to Tom's argument, and I wasn't convinced. But he admitted, and he's one of the sharpest guys we will have out there.
Yeah.
And just hadn't been paying attention. I mean, it's not something he's given himself to. Yeah. A young man that I discipled years ago in Dallas did a note to me. Today, he's up in the Northeast. He's a businessman. He says, I'm a businessman. I'm a member of the Southern Baptist Church. And he said, but I've never heard of critical race theory, intersectionality. What does this have to do with me or my church and the Sunday school class I teach?
Yeah.
He said, what's going on?
Yeah.
So I think that's true.
Yep.
And so we need to educate.
That's right.
We need to educate. We don't need to do scare tactics.
That's
we
right.
We need to tell the truth, the whole truth. We need to let people understand this is what happened. This is what was said. This is what was not said. This is what was offered that was turned down.
Sure.
And these are the people who have done it and promoted it.
Yeah.
And so how do we want to live together as a convention? Is this the way we want to go? If so, then make it clear and let's go.
The conservative,
or y'all go.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that was really interesting about the conservative resurgence showed that the SBC can be turned one way or the other. It showed the liberals how to play the game, and also showed that anybody can play this game. But I walked away with some very confident and resolved about where things are, because I get to know some of the people that were there and talk to the guys there. A lot of people are just trying to manage their church and see what's going on, be connected. It's not as corrupted, I think, as a lot of people are trying to make it out to be. It's just that men need to stand up and be vigilant and talk.
But this happens, the same thing happens at Presbytery.
Sure,
same thing, because good men are busy with their responsibilities at home.
That's right.
Pastoring people on the ground.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, people can get up in the higher echelons of the denomination.
Yep.
They run the meetings, they stack the committees, and things can get pulled way off track by this, because a lot of good men are doing good things.
That's right.
And they don't got time for all this other stuff.
Yep.
Right.
And so it takes a good bit of, I don't know, creativity effort. To like you got to not only do your job on the ground, but you got to go read up on critical race theory. You got to go and get ready for the next Presbytery meeting, the SBC meeting, whatever it is. You got, and it's hard.
It is hard, and but it's worth it.
It
it's
is. Worth it, it is. It's worth it.
Man, I walked away as a trans Baptist. I was very I was a trans Baptist for a week. I it was fun. It was real fun.
I'm gonna talk to you about that, man.
Pastor Askel, Pastor Longshore, thank you guys for joining us. Praying for you guys, a resolve to fight with you guys.
Yeah.
If you're single, get married. You guys, close your ears for this next part. If you're single, get married. Have kids. And if you have kids, go baptize them. Until next week, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Go fight, laugh, and feast. This is Cross Politics.